What's this?
It's a phone.
Yeah.
It's modern. We have the new stuff. Welcome to 2018.
Well, you, yeah. My name's David, and I'm an addict.
Hi, David.
And you've had the young, attractive, unfiltered, passionate.
Thanks.
And now you've got. It's going to be hard, this, isn't it? Now you've got the, that's what my wife referred to, the miserable old git. Who doesn't. I used to score by putting 2p bits into coin boxes to ring people. I'm rather jealous of, I mean, how can you say jealous? I'm not, you know, you just hear people talking now about, you know, couriers coming round and dark web, and then you think, fuck it, must be. Anyway, I won't go into it. I was born, you know, I was in the hard times. I came, well, I am old. I mean, you know, that's the thing. And I mean, I came, I actually thought this was in, I've heard about this meeting. There's a mystique, there's, actually it's cool. You all seem very nice. It's not, you know, what they say is not true. No, but, you know, it's like, oh my God, you're doing Trafalgar Square. Oh God, are you doing Trafalgar Square? You know, because I usually go to a meeting, another meeting on Friday night. And everyone, you know, you're going to be the, now I'm doing me. Oh, you're doing the show at Trafalgar Square. You know, it's like, fucking hell. And just like you, I mean, mine started in November because he asked me in November. So, you know. And I'm arrogant and proud. You know, I want you to love me. And I also know exactly how everyone ought to behave and do their recovery. And I don't have a little harder finding out what I should do, but I always know what everyone else should do. You know, so you have all these. Anyway, but it's not worth talking about. But it's yeah, it's a big thing. Trafalgar Square, and we're here. And I first came here. It wasn't here. It was actually in the crypt, which was a basement, sort of obviously just through that wall. But it was a basement at St Martin's Lane, and it was a Monday night meeting. It was the first NA meeting I went to, and it was in 1982. So we're talking about old. Most people here seem like they weren't alive in 1982. But, and I turned up there, and NA was, well, there were a few meetings, 5 or 6 meetings a week, and about 30 or 40 people in NA. And in a way, thank God, I knew quite a lot of the people in the room. You know, and I sat down, and they talked about stuff like yets. You know, I haven't done this yet, but I could. And I thought, fuck, yeah, that's me. I've done a lot of things, but I just identified, you know, and stuff. And they said to me, you know, and so they were pleased to see me, you know, like, oh, great. And you, and we know David, yeah, great. You come here, you know, it's about time you got here. And, you know, there's a meeting tomorrow, and I can't come tomorrow night. I've got a job in Andover. And the idea in my mind, so I started in the middle, but I have managed to get myself off the drug of choice. And I come up to London because of, I can't remember why actually. Anyway, but see, and this guy said, come to a meeting. And I came to a meeting, but I was going to go and work in this cafe in Andover. And that to me was the responsible grown up thing to do. You know, I've stopped using, I'm going to get a job. You know, it's very interesting, and maybe, you know, next year or something, I'll pop up and see you all, you know. And you've got to go to treatment. You know, they're a bit frightened of newcomers in those days. You know, it's like, oh, fuck, what do we do? You know, shove them into treatment and then get them to learn how to behave and then come to a meeting. And so I went off to this cafe in Andover, which was basically a place where people came out. The pubs used to shut at 3 o'clock in those days. And Andover was a sort of place where they didn't want anyone on an estate in London. They put them on this new estate in Andover. And you go and get pissed up in the pub, come at 3 o'clock, fight between 3 and 5 or 6 in this cafe and then go back in the pub again. And I'm some posh public school boy trying to run the thing. I mean, it was just all wrong. And then a girl walked in who I used to use with, who was detoxing, with her gone home to her family. So within 24 hours, we're driving up to London. I got the money from the till, and I'm using it again. And I came back in in November the 23rd, 1983. But to get to the beginning, because I've got to fill out 40 minutes, I think, so we've got to, I'll do you a bit. I mean, I grew up on a farm in Cornwall, which was a long way away in the 60s. You know, it wasn't, now people go there for holiday. You know, it was kind of like, felt like I was miles from anywhere. And my family were basically good people. You know, and they, their thing was to work and to take care of the children. And then there's, you know, I talked about public school. You know, they didn't take any holidays. We never went on holiday. We had a farm van, which was a car. You know, it was all about putting money together to look after. So everything you from the outside world would say, you know, you couldn't have a more perfect. You're living in the countryside. I learned to work very early because you basically, as soon as you could walk, you were given chores and, you know, and working. I learned good basic disciplines, you know, all sorts of stuff that some people would say, oh, you know, you wouldn't possibly end up a heroin addict if you did all this stuff. And it took me quite a long time in NA to sort of see the part, you know, to me they were like, it was perfect, but clearly it wasn't. In fact, it was so not perfect in some ways that my brother ended up as a priest and I ended up as a heroin addict. And I don't think the two are so far apart. I don't mean that to knock. I'm not knocking him for being a priest. But it's like we needed something. And he found a sort of organized, you know, belief system and stuff like that. And I found my way. And I'm, thank God I found my way. That's what is how I feel today. And I really mean that. It's not, you know, I'm really so pleased that that's the route I took. You know, and both my sisters are married to, well, one's to a vicar and another's to a social worker. You know, so there was something going on, and I don't want to go because it's not a sort of psychoanalyst class, but it's, you know, there was stuff, you know, and previous generations, there was always a black sheep, and this and that, you know, and it was there. And for me, which sounds awfully sort of a high class trauma, but actually being sent away to a boarding school aged 8 for me was traumatic. For my brother, it was great. He was good at sports, he was popular. I was weird. You know, I don't know why, I didn't even know how I was weird. I wanted to be liked by everyone. And didn't seem to know how to bring that about. I even tried to copy the way one guy, you know, the most popular guy in my, you know, how he wrote in a certain way. So I tried to write like him, because I suppose if I wrote like him, I might be, I don't know, you know, it just, but it was deeper than that. But also in and this very nice, and you know, I don't want to knock them too much, but basically there was a fear in there, and I think the fear, the way to deal with the fear was to be good and to do the right thing. And I've picked up those things, and they're not unhelpful life skills, but it's not helpful when the truth gets lost. You know, you weren't angry, you didn't cause a scene, cool, calm and collected, complete opposite. You know, I've learned to put filters on everything. You know, and inside, you know, so there's one thing I want to be approved of, and I want to do the right thing, and I want to be good, but I'm also an addict, and I want to cause chaos and mayhem and be spontaneous. And this was the conflict inside of me. And it erupted when I was 11 or 12 years old. I suddenly had this, I suddenly just didn't give a fuck. And I even today, you know, after several falls, I can't remember exactly what the things are, but I just was answering back. I just didn't give a fuck. You'll go and see the headmaster, so what, bring it on. To the point that I was like, you know, if the Sun newspaper was there, you know, I was the headline. There were people queuing, I can remember distinctly, the whole school queuing up outside some changing rooms to see what I was going to do next, because I'd exploded. So here's something going on here. You know, it's not all quite calm, farmer's boy, nice upbringing. There's some shit going on here. And then I was the sort of weird guy. You know, this didn't, but it just, I couldn't control it. There was a rage and a thing inside of me. And that was a mistake, as far as I could see. I could see that was a mistake. If I wanted to be liked and loved and popular, this was not the right thing. So I shut down, you know, and I learned to be, you know, I learned to read people's moods, to be, I learned particularly good at, if there's a group of four or five of us, I'll find the one who you can take the piss out of and get everyone else on my, you know, it's just a joke. Just you know, a little bit cynical, a little bit, you know. And that's kind of how I carried on through the thing, you know, through the next schooling thing. And I came to, you know, and I left that school, and I somehow picked up. I didn't have, a lot of people seemed to be very clear on what they were thinking and what they're doing. I didn't really know. I bumbled. You know, I think I lost who I was quite early on. And I was just trying not to, I was trying to get have an easy life, really. Don't, you know, I didn't have the passion that I want to be a musician. I want to do this. I want to do that. It was too frightening to do all that. It's just like, I want to keep my head down and do it, you know. But I did think, my idea, there was a guy who used to write these books about people who would start working as a kitchen boarder in a hotel and end up owning hundreds of them, and usually with a bit of dodgy business on the side, you know. And I really liked that sort of idea, that role model. And I thought, if I go and make some money, no one's going to tell me what to do. And I won't have to conform. You know, that dilemma of trying not to be completely out there and also doing what I want when I want. The secret would be to get enough money, and then they'll respect me, whatever, and I can do it. Well, I don't know. I didn't think about it very long. It was just a gist of an idea. So I rushed out of Cornwall up to London to, and this sort of deceit, you know, I drank a bit then, smoked some dope, all that sort of, you know, teenage stuff. But it was really then, you know, I found, in fact, blues, talking about money, that 50p for three pills, you know, and that was from the Gene Machine in the King's Road. And that had me, you know, suddenly, oh, this is it. I feel okay, I can go. This is, in fact, this was brilliant because I can work really well and hard and earn money and do, you know, and it's, and that, actually, I don't want to go on about it all, to get to a point. But basically from that, I then stumbled onto my drug of choice, which I've already told you. And I had such a feeling of peace. You know, I could then sit and do nothing and not feel anxious, you know, just warm. Sorry, I'm not going to try and turn everyone on, but it's just, but you know, that just, an old black and white movie maybe on the TV, you know, dark in the middle of the day in a basement, just, and you know, and I used to deal, and people kind of, you know, it worked for about 6 months, you know, I had lots of people coming around, and you know, and I was in the center of things, and I had a job that my parents and people, my uncle had helped me get, and I had to wear a suit and go to this place. So they were tick, they were all happy. What's David doing? Oh, he's working in this job, in an office, and then I'm dealing at night. But I couldn't get to the job every day. I mean, there was a lot going on. And then, oh, you know, anyway, it transpired that, you know, because my uncle got me the job, they let me do the whole 6 month probation and then brought me in and said, actually, I don't think it's suitable for you, this job, or something like that, you know. And then there was a big drama. And in fact, I met someone in recovery many years later who worked in the same office. And he said, you know, they still talk about this guy who used to use gear in the loos. And I thought no one knew a thing about it. And there was, you know, it's so blindingly obvious what was going on. Anyway, so anyway, my big idea when that all came out, and it's, you know, big, my uncle, my grandmother rang me up, what the hell have you done? Are you getting, you know? And I said, no, I want to join the army. I don't know, I mean, where did that come from? But the only thing I knew was that I don't know why I knew this, but I knew that nothing would happen for several months. And when I don't know how old I was, but at that age, several months seemed a long way away. A bit like doing this chair in November. And so I could just carry on as I was. But then January the 6th arrived, and I was cold turkey in Winchester Barracks, you know, and doing all the stuff that you do as a recruit in the army. And that didn't last. I think someone grasped me up there, actually. There was a guy who used to hang around on the edges. He was in the same regiment or something, and suddenly they kept asking me questions about what would you do if someone was using in your thing. You know, again, I didn't quite get it at the time, but looking back I realized that there'd been a lot of conversations going on behind the scenes, and they were asking me anyway, whatever, they you know, thank God, because that time, you know, I mean, who would need someone out there pissed or using, or, you know, I mean, it was anyway, so I was out of that. And the only other thing about, you know, basically, you know, like everyone's story, you know, okay, so I had 6 months where everything seemed to be fine, and then I had about 6 years when I was trying to stop. But I wanted to stop without having to stop using. Yeah. That's really it. I wanted to stop, but yeah. And and it shrunk my life. It wasn't that big at the beginning, but it. And for me, that's, if you want to sort of identify addiction, shrinking, like a flower blossoms. When I'm in addiction mode, I creep back in and ultimately die, I guess, through using or suicide. That seems to be the end result of active addiction or untreated addiction. So I was in a very small little world, and my brother, who by then was quite into, he hadn't become a priest yet, but he was right into all this stuff. And he said, you're using again. And I had got to the point where, this is when I had the job in Andover, and so I had a bit of money coming in. I was surrounded by some people who I hadn't ripped off. There were opportunities, which at other times, you know, I mean, I used to score in Kennison Market a lot, and you know, I used to go, and the guys even gave me, they said, look, have a free bag, but go and buy yourself some shoes, you know. And then I couldn't score off the guy, because obviously I didn't buy some shoes, I bought another bag, and the next day he came around, and I still didn't have the, you know, the soles flapping all the time. So I've been in worse physical, material situations than I was then. But he came and said, you're using again. And I said, yes. So he rang up my dad, and I'd done a detox on the farm once before, and there was a well-worn path, there was a doctor down there who knew there was a stuff called Temgesic in those days that you shot up, and it was a sort of substitute, which is quite nice. And the doctor knew the prescription, you know, and I knew, and I had to go and work on the farm, and I'd get healthy and strong. And so I, 2 days, basically my brother, you know, this call went out, he's at it again, the right, rescue mission. I'm meant to drive down to, in this old banger I had, down from London to Cornwall. It took me 2 days to get from London to Cornwall, from that moment, you know, and I had no idea the trauma I was causing. You talked about the damage you do to other people, you know. I arrived and my, you know, it's like, what's your problem? I mean, I'd just been stopping in service stations and shooting up, and you know, just you know, I was on my way, but no telephone call, no nothing. So my dad's, you know, this is really about my ninth step in a way, but my dad's driving up and down the M5 or M4, what is it, the M5, looking for a burnt out car on the side of the road, because he knows that his junkie son is fucked up again and is on the way home, and he hasn't heard anything for 2 days. And I've got children now, and, you know, fuck, that's a thing to go through. I thought, what are you fussing about? I said I was coming, you know. Anyway, but I turned up there, and I burst into tears in front of my father. And that, we did not, you know, he's ex-army farmer. Crying wasn't part of the thing that men did in our family. And he actually said, look, you know, it's going to be okay. And so, but it was just a relief. I knew that I was going to get £50 a week wages for working on the farm. £10 went to my mum for food, £10 to me for cigarettes, and he kept 30 quid for the debts he knew were going to follow me, because he'd done this before. And to me, and I had my Temjizik, and to me, age 24, that was a really good deal. I had left school at 18, or college, you know, at 18, to make my fortune, to say, fuck you all, I'll do what I want. And at 24, my sole ambition was to have my Temjizik script and 10 quid a week for cigarettes. And if I look at what does spiritual mean, this is a spiritual rock bottom. Because a 24-year-old should be buzzing with life, excited about stuff, whatever they're doing, but full of not beaten. I mean, I always usually say when I share about this, it's like, it was almost like I wanted to go into old people's home and they wheel me out, give me the medication, put a blanket over my things and say, sit there, and I'd wait, you know, for the next meal. That was kind of my state of mind, retreat back to the thing, you know. And shit, I better get a move on. I thought 40 minutes was going to be impossible, so I was panning. Anyway, so that's a spiritual rock bottom. I came back to NA, and this time I stayed. This time I was terrified. You know, I am not. You know, I was terrified. I was terrified. I knew that if I used again, how quickly and where I was going to go. I didn't go to treatment. I'm really glad I didn't, in a way, which is in no way saying anything bad about anyone I did or about treatment centers. What I'm glad about, what it gave me, is that whatever's happened in the 33 years since then, the only thing I know is NA's what works for me. And it's extraordinary how that's worked. I've often not believed that, but ultimately that's where I've ended up. And I think what we have here is just such an... I mean, first of all, if I have to write a gratitude list and I can't think, someone told me, said in the meeting, I thought it was brilliant. He said, my sponsor said, I don't know how to write a gratitude list. You know, what am I? He said, are you on fire? The guy said, no. He said, right, we'll put that down. And I thought, well, you know, what a great attitude to start with a gratitude list, because I don't know. I know how to be ungrateful. I can moan and moan and moan. And now the scientists have now worked out why that is. You know, there are neurons. I won't bore you because that would be 4 hours instead of 40 minutes. But there's stuff in our brains that become pathways and it becomes habits. Mm. And I'm a habitual moaner. I'm habitually negative. So you ask me to write down something that's good. You're asking me to play, I don't know, squash with my left hand or write with my left hand. It's so unnatural. But I'm not really grateful for that. You know, how can I? But I'm quite happily tell you that my life is shit. It's always been shit. In fact, I'm shit, and that's the problem. And I'm so shit in such a complicated and intense and unique way. There's no fucking thing that's going to sort me out. And what's more, based on this evidence, all of my life is shit and will be shit. And it's fucked. I have no evidence for this. I'm 58. I'm still alive. I've got a wife. I've got 3 children. I've got a business that, you know, supports me. And I'm in NA and I'm clean and I could go on and on and on. But like to write that down, easier to say it's all a disaster. Anyway, so that's gratitude, Liz. And that's my mind. And the thing is what I learned tonight, because I'm going to speed up a bit, I'll tell you a bit about what I found out. But what I found out coming here, and what's so incredible about this, is these sorts of things. This is the experience of addicts helping other addicts. And if I want to put, what I was going to put on a gratitude list, is I'm born within the 53, within 60 or 70 years of when something called Narcotics Anonymous was started. Imagine I was born in the last, any time in the last 10,000 years, I was fucked. You know, now we have something where we understand what we are and we understand how to help each other. And we don't like to hear from, I became a Christian for a while too, but after the army. But that didn't work either. I was looking for some solution. My solution is being in this room with really, I was going to say really sick, but that's rude. Dark. People who have a dark, fun, mischievous, that's just how we are. You know, intensely annoying sometimes. But there's nothing. You know, when you go into the army, everyone's sort of proper. And if you go to these very nice people who tried to help me, and I went to some Christian camp with my brother, and they're awfully nice people. But it's like, you just want to do something really bad. You know, to just, they're not, and my wife always says this, so I'll give her the credit, they're not my tribe. And it's okay, because I don't then have to say, they're all rubbish, they don't know what they're talking about, we need to teach them, we need to show them. No, they're happy in their tribe. But I'm in my tribe. And when I came to NA, I found my tribe. I came to a meeting, we sat around, you'd go out for coffee afterwards and talk. I mean, it was mad in those days. It was great, because there were still only 6 or 7 meetings. We were on a mission from God, like the Blues Brothers. We were going to open meeting. I used to drive up to Oxford every Tuesday night with a friend to open a meeting there, and we used to attend that. And then we used to go down to Hoxton on Friday nights, and all sorts of stuff. It was rude, but it was insane. Because there weren't many of us, and there wasn't much, but there were people I felt comfortable with. They were my people, and the problem that I had is that, right now I look back, I use, for whatever I said, about 6 years. I'm 58 years old. Drug, that whole thing is not the deal for me now. I mean, obviously it's a deal because it was a very obvious symptom that there was something not right. That I was trying to kill myself and, all the blah, blah, blah. Particularly from quite a good start in life. But if that was only a problem, I haven't used for 33 years. That's all over, why aren't I? But the problem is I'm an addict. And I mean, I'm so many other things, a father, a husband, a thing. But my primary thing is I'm an addict. That's what I still believe. And if you all left, I would still come, and I don't mean this to be sort of, but I really would find a recovery text, open a meeting and sit in it, for the next people to come. Because it's just, and if I die and I find out, that was a mistake, you could have actually, if you'd taken a combination of drugs like this, you could have da-da-da, I don't think I would be unhappy. I'd say, no, I'm glad I'm an addict and I'm glad I'm here. Because really the thing for me is that, in the beginning of the first step, it talks about what is addiction, and it talks about a physical compulsion to use. Well, for me, not using removes that physical compulsion. It's over. And my analogy I use is, if I go into a boxing room with Mike Tyson, I'm going to get beaten to shit. Actually, all my analogies are out of date, by the way. I was going to say Muhammad Ali, but I thought I'd update it a bit. But if I go in, I get beaten to shit. It doesn't matter if I come in from the left corner, the right corner, if I lead with the left, lead with the, I'm fucked. But if I don't go in a ring anywhere near where Mike Tyson is, I don't have a problem. So I'm powerless over Mike Tyson, but he does not affect my life because I've never been in a boxing ring with him. And that's how it is with drugs. So I don't use. Boom. The obsession, the mental problem of the obsession is another thing. And that obsession to use, and the using part, because obsession covers obviously many things, but the obsession to use left me in Knowles Court Road a week after I came back and came to NA, started coming. And I was trying to work out how to use and get to the meeting clean, which is what I would call an addict's dilemma. It's, no other person would understand this, and everyone in this room, or I imagine everyone in this room completely understands this. There must be a third way. If I think hard enough and go around, there's got to be a fucking answer to this. It's just got, and I had my little address book because of telephone and the coins and all that, where the dealer's numbers, And up came this phrase that I must have heard in the rooms, is we cannot use no matter what, whether I feel good or bad, whether I'm ill or well, whether someone dies or whatever. I cannot use no matter what. This is an absolute. And I can deal with absolutes. They're quite easy. You know, it's like, and the moment I took that on board, it's like, fuck it. I'm not using. Address book gone. I don't need it. I am not using. And that's called a decision. And the worst thing for my obsessive mind, you know, doesn't like decisions. What it likes is an open-ended thing. If she says this, then I'll go out with her. But if she doesn't, then I'm going to do... No. As Marcus Aurelius and the Stoics would say, I do what I have to do, and you'll do what you have to do. Once I've got in that position, you have no power over me. Okay? Drugs. I'm not using anymore. Do what you will. There's no judgment on that, but I'm not using. And I haven't had any obsession to use since that moment, so that was nice. But they said the root of our problem is a spiritual condition. It's got nothing to do with the compulsion to use and the mental thing. These are just symptoms. The root of my thing is a spiritual condition, and the spiritual thing is self-centeredness. And I would actually say self-centered fear. And I've been looking quite a lot recently in actually what is causes me to still behave the way I do and stuff I do. And I would go further than that. And I would say, I have a fear that I am not good enough and you're going to find out. And that's really it. So I need to put on some act. It's pointless because you know who I am just by looking at me. You've all made your mind up. But I think that if I behave this way, if I get this car, or if I marry that person, or if I have a house, or if I do this, or if I make money, then you won't, you know, like I said at the beginning, these things will stop you finding out this dreadful truth that I'm not lovable, I'm not good enough, and I'm not loved. It's got nothing to do with drugs. You know, I took drugs because it's very painful being unloved and trying to make everyone love you and all the, you know, complications and stuff like that. So, oh God, I've got to say something else. Right. So, and the thing about it is that, I mean, I like reading stuff and finding out about stuff and blah, blah, blah. One of the most interesting books I read many years ago, and I probably get it all wrong now, but it was a book called Parted On, which was the story of how Bill Wilson started AA, which we, you know, very gratefully got our stuff from. And basically, because I wouldn't have long enough to go on about it all, but basically, you know, with a doctor, he discovered that he couldn't drink part-time. It was all or nothing. So that was the complete abstinence. He then went to something called the Oxford Movement, and he found, got in with some spiritual people, and he found that he needed a higher power, and because his mind was a bit fucked, and so he needed a higher power. And the most important thing to me, well, not the most important, they're all important, but these are the three cornerstones, I believe, of NA, and certainly from what I believe in, is that he had stayed sober for a while, and he was in some hotel on business or something, and he desperately wanted to drink. And he rang up a vicar, a priest, I think, or someone, you know, saying, what should I do? I'm in this town. And the guy said, well, why didn't you go to the hospital, which is where they used to put all the drunks? Go to the drunk wing in the hospital and go and tell, help someone else there. And talk to them. And he did that, and the obsession left. So for me, as much as I have to do a fourth step and a regular tenth step, and I have to keep a check on myself and be open and honest and all the rest, there's a limit to how self-obsessed I can be. And I think, if I wanted to be controversial, sometimes in, maybe I don't know all NA, but sometimes around some of the meetings, we get a little bit too tied up with trying to be, or I do, I want to feel good all the time. Find me the latest, and if you stay around for 33 years, you see quite a lot of fashions come in and out of NA. Find me the latest book, doctor, someone who's going to tell me the key that I can make myself so perfect that I don't get hurt and I'm and everything's fine. And actually, what I think is a lot of what we do is about getting outside of ourselves. You know, most of the things is, you know, talk to a newcomer, come to a meeting and share. You know, I want to stay under a duvet and isolate. It's my ideal situation, okay? Ring someone up, help people. You know, all these things are all about actually, instead of getting in here, and just like me trying to work out how to stay clean and not use, go into this mental, no, the easiest way to get rid of that is to actually talk to someone else. And suddenly I move into another parallel universe, and all that angst is gone. I don't do it every day, and just very quickly, in the last 2 minutes, I was going along pretty well. I got a sponsor. As I say, I got, that's a whole nother story. I got married, which was wonderful. But it didn't come. I must have a girlfriend. Well, I like her. I quite enjoy being, right, you're my girlfriend. You know, but there was all sorts of weird shit. Some girl in America that I thought I fancied and spent day, you know, trying to ring up, and we arranged to go to a convention together, and she went with her boyfriend and I was there, and it's like, oh fuck, the pain, you know. I thought I was going, and I'm stuck in some hotel, in some cool hippie hotel in San Francisco with her and her boyfriend in bed, in, and there's a sort of no real part, nothing but the part, some caftan curtain or something between me and so you know, I was mad, all this stuff. But these things work out. You know, you do what you got to do, and then out of the blue, someone came along, and you know, and I'm married. And we've been married 25 years, and you know, blah, blah. So, and I didn't know what to do for work. I was working at McDonald's when I first got clean, and I now end up in business. In fact, Tony used to live above our cafe and cause mayhem. So, so all of that happened, but I'd done the first 9 steps: business, wife, children. 30-something years, for maybe nearly 40, you know, everything's going pretty cool from a guy whose ambition was to sit in a wheelchair with a blanket over his things. And I still kept going to meetings, but I sort of stopped using my sponsor as a sponsor. I didn't move from the 9th step to the 10th step. I didn't really realize I had. I've been clean a lot. You know, whatever time I'm clean, just by the nature of events, I've been clean longer than most people. So you sort of think, yeah, I've done all sorts in NA, and I'm Mr. NA. And I'm going to, but I'm miserable. And certain circumstances happened with the business and things like that, which is all, the plan all went a bit pear-shaped. And I was stuck in this thing, and I was on interferon as well, and there, you know, various things went on. And I went through several years of what anyone else would call depression. And I was depressed. But I would call untreated addiction. And for those, you know, people, and I went, eventually after that, it took, as I say, a few years. I mean, I was driving down the A3 thinking, well, actually, fuck me, it'd be so much. I was in the loop again, you know, I can't, and I couldn't see a way out. I just pull off the road. And then I thought of my children, and I thought, actually, you know, I don't know whether I would or wouldn't, but that's the state of mind I was in. But all clean, you know, in still going to meetings. The disease of addiction is, in the book, it says it's cunning, baffling, powerful, and insidious. And insidious is creeping. I can see it in all of you, as I said. I mean, I'm an expert on all that. But in me, it had come in. And I believe that, the for whatever reason, that the end result of addiction is death. I wasn't going to use, because I was much too proud to use. But I killed myself instead. Well, addiction's one. So... anyway, I ended up asking this guy, who unfortunately has died now, but he'd been donkey's years clean in AA. He's a wonderful character, and I went to him, and he told me to write a gratitude list. But now I've got such a serious fucking problem. You know, it's got this, and the money, and the kid, and this, and that. He said, write a gratitude. Anyway, and I went on, and that was some years ago. And like I said, you know, that life situation I thought I could never solve, I found the solution in NA. You know, it was back to the same stuff. And that I need to, and I'll finish now, I need to do my 10th step. Because addiction's still there. once I've done that, I'm now very much into the 11th and I suppose, yeah, the 12th step. And there's kind of a new hope. And I do feel, not all the time, but that idea that I'm not loved and not good enough, I actually feel the connection that I am loved and it's okay. Good things and bad things will happen and come and go, but actually inside of me, irrelevant to them, it's not I will be happy when, I'll be happy if, it's I'm going to be happy now. Maybe because I'm old and I'm going to die soon, so I've got to, I'm not going to get happy now, I'm fine, you know. But whatever the reason, that's what I'm working on now, and that is a joy. And when I have that joy, I then am free to maybe help someone else. Thank you.
Thanks, David.